Netanyahu really needs to go. He is a walking disaster who needs to leave the scene. I think there's no doubt that this is crimes against humanity, war crimes every day. Challenges that we face, say the war in Ukraine or this war in Israel and Palestine, these are easily solvable problems. This is not quantum mechanics. This is pretty straightforward.
Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde. Ich begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht. Unabhängig, kritisch, zuversichtlich am Mittwoch, dem 1. November 2023. Und ich bin sehr froh und dankbar, dass wir als Gast in unserer Sendung haben einen Vertrauten, einen Autor der Weltwoche und auch schon Interviewgast unseres Programms. Es ist, und ich werde jetzt auf Englisch wechseln, it's the great privilege to have you on the program, Professor Jeffrey Sachs.
Thank you.
From Columbia University. Thank you very much. It's highly appreciated that we can take your precious time for insights into world politics.
I'm delighted to be with you, let me say. It's a privilege for me.
Great, thank you very much. I just made an interview with Colonel McGregor a few days ago, and he drew a gloomy picture of this war in the Middle East. He says that one should protect Israel from itself. It could be that Prime Minister Netanyahu is bombing Israel into the abyss. I mean, this was the metaphor. This was the description he used. What do you make of that? How do you see this war of Israel now against the Palestinians? Can it succeed, or is it self-destructible?
I think it is self-destructive, or I should say Bibi destructive. Bibi Netanyahu is absolutely a divisive element in Israel. He had already brutally divided Israeli society before the October 7 Hamas terrorist attack. He obviously led a government that completely let Israel's guard down in terms of basic border security and intelligence processing. He should resign. He has no business doing what he's doing, but he's desperately trying to somehow save his political life by going to war that is going to be completely terrible for Israel. There's no way that Israel wins its deeper objectives from this war. It's killing thousands of innocent people, especially women and children in Gaza. This brutality and carnage is in front of the whole world. People are aghast, as they should be. This needs to stop. Netanyahu really needs to go, but Israel has different ways to approach this. It's not even trying diplomatically. It's just saying, well, we're going to go to war. Netanyahu said this is the time of war. He's wrong. He is a walking disaster who needs to leave the scene.
Well, Prime Minister Netanyahu is not here in the program, so I'm his duty defender, or how do you call that in English? I try to bring in his probably his perspective, and I say, well, he's in a tragic situation. He's in a desperate situation. On the one hand, you have this massacre from October 7. I mean, a head of state, of government, he has to do something. You're confronted with a terror organization. So you try to rebuild, in a way, the security or the... you have to defend yourself. You have to attack your attacker. Is there not some argument that can be made what should he have done? I mean, he cannot just sit back and wait. What do you say?
He should have resigned immediately. He's a disgrace. He failed. And what is one of the dark truths that is known to experts and should be known to the public is Netanyahu played with Hamas. He built Hamas. He supported Hamas. He gave Hamas the base in Gaza because he wanted to weaken the Palestinians in general, because he's been playing a game all along to avoid a Palestinian state. That's been his thing. And one of the things he decided to do was that if the Palestinian Authority represented both the West Bank and Gaza, it would become too strong. So he bolstered Hamas, and you can read about this everywhere now. This is even told by his own political associates. So no, he should not have sat back. He should leave the scene. Now, I know you're playing his personality. I would never be so rude to you, but if he were sitting in front of me, that's what I would tell him. Go. You failed. You have divided the country. You have prevented a political solution. The world, rightly, and most Israelis, when they're not misled or terrified, have long called for a political settlement with the Palestinians. And you, Mr. Netanyahu, have blocked that all along. You actually bolstered Hamas. You fell asleep at the switch. You did not even protect Israel with basic security at the border on October 7th. So just go. That's what I would tell him.
I mean, this is an absolute surprise that Israel, with its army and all these guards and these walls and these surveillance systems, could have been so much duped, I mean, surprised by Hamas. What do you make of that? How is that possible? How do you explain that?
They are arrogant. They believe that by using force, by imposing an apartheid state, they can make things quiet, and it doesn't work. And when you listen to people on the ground who know year after year, they will tell you the situation is seething. You know, the human rights groups have called to Gaza the world's largest open air prison, not by accident. The human rights groups have called Israeli occupation of Palestine an apartheid state. These are not the words from me. These are the words from groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Now, the arrogance is both Israel's and its backer, the United States, which also has a view that diplomacy is for losers. We don't need diplomacy. We need military power. We don't have to talk to anybody. We don't have to negotiate with anybody. We don't have to settle with anybody. We just need to impose solutions. Now, this is false, and there have been so many warnings that this is false. But if you ask me what led to this failure, it wasn't a technical failure. It was an attitudinal failure. It was arrogance. And it was arrogance also of the U.S. After all, our national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, wrote an article, which he wrote before October 7, but it came in my mailbox in Foreign Affairs, the last issue of 2023. And what is the pullout quote from that article? The Middle East is quieter than it has been in 20 years. That's our national security advisor. And he says in this article that the solutions in Gaza have really quieted down. Well, that shows a detachment from ground reality. So the Israelis and the Americans talk to each other. They don't talk to anyone else in the world, really. Then they get the idea that all is safe. A disaster hits. By the way, it's not unlike 9/11. 9/11 was a catastrophic failure of the American homeland security. Not just that it was a terrible event, but there were signs. They were told that groups were training to use planes to attack buildings. This was specific information. And so this is the same story. What did Bush do afterwards? Well, he became a great hero for a moment, you know, because he said, we're going to retaliate. There was never an honest moment what did you guys do? How did you blow this so terribly? And we have a presidential system in the United States. We're stuck with that. You know, it wasn't bad in 1787, a four-year term, but a prime minister can leave from morning till afternoon, and it's time for Netanyahu just to leave.
How severe is the human rights situation or the human suffering now at Gaza? I've read it's about 8,000 dead so far. Have you, from the UN, have you any specific numbers, also children, civilians affected here?
I'm only reading the public information, so I have no inside information. But the information's coming from all sources, from, of course, the Gaza health authorities, who are authoritative, from Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, from the United Nations. And we just had a resignation of senior UN official who said that this is essentially almost, I don't know what word he used, whether he said genocide or something terrible, but he resigned saying the world's just standing by as these horrific events are taking place. So I think there's no doubt that this is crimes against humanity, war crimes every day, absolutely untenable, and all put forward as if there is no alternative. This is the biggest problem. Now, why? Of course, there are alternatives. There are other ways to make security. There are other ways to actually solve the politics. But the idea of Israel and the United States is never to look below the surface at the underlying political issues, because that might require concessions to the other side. For example, the establishment of a state of Palestine, which the U.S. mouths as its objective. In fact, every day says it right now, because the U.S. has signed all these U.N. Security Council resolutions. But tell me, has Bibi Netanyahu said a word about that? Don't bet on it for your life, because of course he opposes every possible diplomatic way out of this. And so to say that the only alternative is to kill thousands or tens of thousands of innocent people is basically to hide two things. One, the personal failure of Netanyahu and his cabinet. And second, to hide the political solution, which these hardliners don't want us to even think about, but is the only way to make peace. And in the context of a political solution, you can demobilize, you can disarm groups because you have a political settlement. And that is what is needed here.
So you're saying that militarily, it's impossible to beat a terrorist group like Hamas, which is now hidden also in bunkers. I mean, as far as I know, they're using also civilian facilities in order to have their supplies there, some weapons and even headquarters. So if I understand you correctly, there is no military solution against this sort of enemy.
Of course, I'm not a military expert, but what I would say is that if there is a military solution, it would involve the deaths also of tens of thousands of innocent people. So it would constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity. There is no military solution that does not involve crimes against humanity. And that's the problem. In other words, it's not whether Israel could bomb Gaza to smithereens. It probably could. But could it do it in a way which is consistent with any kind of legitimacy, moral, practical, political legitimacy of Israel going forward? No, that can't be done. So yes, it may be possible to defeat Hamas. I'm not sure, but it is not possible to do this in a civilized, law-abiding way. And so Israel needs to think before it severs relations with the rest of the world's nations.
Mm-hmm. The influential Wall Street Journal argued that if you are waging war against this kind of guerrilla type terrorist enemy, it's inevitable that you have civilian casualties. And everybody who says you should have no civilian casualties is, in other words, denying the right to self-defense to Israel. What are you making of this argument in the Wall Street Journal?
The Wall Street Journal is the leading voice of the U.S. Wealthy establishment. So what I make of it is that this is the standard and expected expression of the most self-entitled and powerful group in the world. It is essentially the might makes right approach. Nobody has to answer to the international community, to international law, to standards of humanity. So I make of it what I've made of the Wall Street Journal for the last 68 years. It speaks the voice of very powerful people who do not believe that they are bound by rules of morality and decency in international law, I'm afraid. But this is exactly America at its power structure. This is what I basically bemoan every day. It is the arrogance that has gotten the United States into perpetual wars. It's the arrogance that has led countries that are supported by the United States to believe that they don't need diplomacy either. It's the same arrogance that has led Ukraine nearly to complete destruction by now, not at Putin's hands in the sense that people think, but by the failure to negotiate at all, because they voted a law, no negotiation. Now, why would they vote a law, no negotiation? Because the United States told them to. And what does the Wall Street Journal represent? It represents precisely, clearly, explicitly, the power structure of the elite of the United States. So what the Wall Street Journal said, frankly, I could have predicted before they wrote it.
It is striking, and a lot of people I talk to seem to notice that. They see that with the war in the Ukraine, the so-called West was very keen on denouncing any breach of international law. They were even putting an indictment against President Putin before the criminal court in Den Haag. And now, if there are other possible crimes, one can say, against civilian populations, the West and the American and also the European authorities, they don't say nothing. Do you see, I mean, it's obvious that they have double standards here. How dangerous is that? I mean, I was just thinking, I mean, the international law, which is some kind of benchmark or hallmark of something, an ideal we should strive to preserve. But with these double standards in the eyes of many, many people, of millions of people on the planet, what's happening with international law right now?
You know, the United States made a good start, a brilliant start in 1945, championing the formation of the United Nations to pick up the remnants of the League of Nations, which had not joined in the previous generation. And the United States, in the very person of Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady of the United States, wife of Franklin Roosevelt, our greatest president, the one who brought the United Nations, oversaw the formation and the promulgation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. But the United States took a fateful turn in 1947 with the National Security Act, which established the CIA and which put the U.S. On a path of secret wars, covert operations, a security state, and without rehashing all of the Cold War, let me just summarize. The U.S. led 64 covert regime change operations between 1947 and 1989. That means usually the CIA in the lead overthrowing foreign governments, right and left. International law has never played much of a role for the United States since 1947. And my whole life, I'm born in 1954, the United States has been overthrowing governments, right and left, by the way. And I've, since I'm an international specialist, I've seen a lot of this close up. The idea that the U.S. abides by international law is, of course, silly. It's not even a school child should have that idea. When the United States gets its way at the UN, it says, okay, good. When the U.S. doesn't get its way at the UN, it says, okay, who cares? And this is basically the prerogative of one country in the world, you know, the only country that has 800 military bases around the world in 80 countries. So no, the U.S. does not take seriously international law, has not since 1947. And it's a shame. It's a little bit like Rome keeping the trappings of the Republic, but slipping into empire. Well, the United States in 1947 slipped into empire. We still have the trappings of Congress and so forth. We even have the trappings of a president, because you shouldn't take too seriously what the president does. They're not in charge necessarily either on these issues. We have a permanent war machine always revving. We have CIA all over Ukraine. Come on, this is the real world, not the rhetoric of international law, which is left to the other 192 countries of the UN, many of which would really like international law, by the way. They don't have the power of the United States. So they say better to live under law than just under whatever the United States deems it are the rules of the day. So the short answer is hypocrisy is not an exception. It is the rule, but it's the rule, it's the prerogative of the most powerful in their mind. This is why it so much comes down to arrogance repeatedly. And the basis of arrogance is to forget the most fundamental adage of life. And that what goes around comes around. You know, if you behave this way, well, times are going to change and you're going to suffer the consequences. We once had somebody named Jesus who said that the most important law of all was do to others what you would have them do to you. Confucius said the same thing. In other words, there should be a principle that applies to everybody. That's the basic idea. Immanuel Kant said the same thing at the end of the 18th century. Mm-hmm. And the United States has been so arrogant for so long, it doesn't believe it. And then countries like Israel, which have very also particular histories, and one should never underestimate what the Holocaust has meant for shaping the mindset and understanding of the world among Israeli leaders. Israel is believed. We have the U.S. at our back, and so international law, not so much. This is the tragic reality, because we really need international law in an international world if we're not going to be at war all the time.
We see growing anger in the Islamic world, in the Muslim world. We have seen this speech by Turkey's President Erdogan, which was very confrontative, was very aggressive. You see other voices, you see growing anger. Do you think that this whole war and the way how Israel wages this war could turn this whole thing into a worldwide mess, in some kind of global confrontation, even into a third world war?
Again, we should never underestimate how one damn thing can lead to the next. And that's why crises need to be solved, not just smirked at. You know, a couple of gunshots by some kids in Sarajevo in 1914 set off World War I, which we're not out of yet, because we're still living with the consequences of that war, exactly in Israel and Palestine, by the way. And that was one damn thing leading to the next, to mobilization, to threats, to this and that, and suddenly war in August 1914. And we're on the verge of that right now. The arrogance of Israel in this, or rage or desperation, or however you want to characterize the emotions of it, the complete failure of Europe to have a coherent thought in its head, I must say, on this, you know, Europe all abstaining from a UN Security Council, a UN General Assembly resolution calling for what? For a humanitarian ceasefire. Europe can't even figure that out anymore, is how bad things are in Europe. Of course, I'm exaggerating a tiny bit because France and Spain voted in favor of the humanitarian ceasefire, but most of the European
Switzerland
Union.
Too.
Yeah, oh, did. I didn't realize that. That's good. But what's Europe cannot figure out dozens of countries to have a humanitarian ceasefire? It's unbelievable. The United States, I understand. You know, I don't like, I don't agree with, I don't approve, but at least I understand. Europe, I don't understand how it cannot find a coherent idea, whether it's about Ukraine or whether it's about Palestine and Israel, because the Europe sold its foreign policy soul to the United States, for heaven's sake. There's no thought in Europe about normalcy right now, about diplomacy. And this is really a terrible problem. So the answer is yes, things can easily get out of hand because we already have shelling coming from Yemen. Okay, maybe Hezbollah, maybe the United States, some troops will be hit. Then the United States will go bomb Iranians someplace, and then the war will escalate. And I cannot stress to you enough how stupid some of American politicians are. If you want names, start with Lindsey Graham, who immediately called for a war with Iran. These people just absolutely want to egg us on to self-destruction, because to know them is to understand this. Not a coherent, rational idea in their heads.
In this week's Weltwoche edition, we have the privilege to publish your most recent piece on this conflict. The English title is, if I get it correctly here, I got the German translation, Turning Carnage into Peace.
Yes.
This is a very concrete, a very specific path you are depicting here, you're showing here, from this carnage, as you say, to peace. Could you give us the landmarks, the milestones of the path to peace now in this difficult situation?
Thank you. Thanks for publishing it also. Well, it starts really with von Clausewitz, the German war theorist after Napoleon, who made the most perceptive observation about war of modern times, which is that war is the continuation of politics with other means. When you see a war, think politics. In other words, what is the underlying political driver of this violence, and then address it? And the underlying driver of this violence is the need to implement a Palestinian state as a member of the United Nations and with control over the Islamic holy sites of East Jerusalem and with a capital in East Jerusalem. Now, that's not some great insight. That is the content of UN resolution after resolution for decades. And the UN General Assembly resolution that just passed with a vote of 140 yes to 14 against said the same thing, a two-state solution. So Netanyahu blocks this. He's got to go anyway because of the disaster that he oversaw. But an Israeli government needs to recognize there is no peace, there is no way out of this, there is no security, there is no solution without a two-state solution. And the rest of the world needs to be very clear that this is the only way. It's been on the books as international law for decades. The United States has reiterated its commitment to this. Make this the centerpiece of peace right now. So the first thing I call for is the Israeli government, presumably led by a new prime minister, which could happen within the next 5 minutes in the right way, to say we are ready for a political settlement based on UN resolutions, both in the Security Council and in the General Assembly. And on that basis, the Arab League and, in fact, the world's nations and the UN Security Council commit to Israel's comprehensive security and to the disarmament and demobilization of these military jihadist groups, starting with Hamas and also the Islamic Jihad and others. Now, those groups are backed by Iran, among other countries. I deal a lot with Iranian diplomats. Iran is ready for normal diplomatic relations. In fact, Iran negotiated normal diplomatic relations with Europe and the United States, and the United States pulled out of the agreement. So all who say, oh, you can't negotiate with Iran, it's typical. You know, that's the lie told by the powerful. The United States broke the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, negotiated solemnly by Europe and the United States and Iran, and then Trump pulled out of it. So Iran can be brought into this with the sanctions dropped against Iran and with Iran a participant in the world and able to stop this nonstop U.S. attack against its diplomacy when Iran has shown it's ready to engage. Not only the JCPOA, Iran has just joined the BRICS countries. So China, Brazil, and others can help Iran to support this demilitarization and this demobilization. So this is the second part. We don't need a war in Gaza. We need a peace in order to stop the militarism. Of course, at the same time, Israel should not let its guard down on its border. This isn't a matter of trust. It never should have incurred October 7 if it was doing the normal job, not the heroism, just the normal job at the border. So in the meantime, I argue that Hamas is not some fundamental existential threat to Israel today or tomorrow. It isn't. In fact, it's trapped inside Gaza. So Israel needs to keep its border guard up, but to move to politics. And then on that basis, the UN Security Council should oversee the establishment of a sovereign Palestine that becomes the 194th member of the United Nations, and crucially is given its capital properly in East Jerusalem, and control over the Islamic holy sites, which are extremely important because the Israelis keep abusing the Islamic holy sites. So rather than stoking religious war, we should have responsibility. And this is also possible. And then my last pillar of peace is to help fund normal economy and development. But first, stop destroying Gaza because it's going to be very expensive to rebuild. And just like I said, stop destroying Ukraine and then talking about a $750 billion program to rebuild. Much cheaper not to destroy it in the first place. But our dunderheads in our foreign policy in the United States, what passes for foreign policy, don't get it in any event. This is my basic point. A political solution, a demilitarization and demobilization, bringing Iran back in normal diplomatic relations, a sovereign Palestine with its capital in East Jerusalem and control over the Islamic holy sites, and a financial program to put the new state of Palestine on its feet.
Last quick point. We're talking always, we have to talk about very dark issues. There is a lot of darkness around us. A personal question to wrap it up. Where is your where is the silver lining? Where do you see the beam of light in this very dark world at the moment? What gives you reason for optimism?
You know, it's a very straightforward answer, which is the challenges that we face, say the war in Ukraine, which is a war caused by this stupidity of the U.S. trying to enlarge NATO to Ukraine of all places, or this war in Israel and Palestine, which is a war over Israel's intransigence in a two-state solution and instead trying to impose an apartheid system. These are easily solvable problems. This is not quantum mechanics. This is not, you know, deep cosmology. This is pretty straightforward. And so that's a great ray of hope. In fact, the other ray of hope is that almost the whole world says, yeah, duh, of course. They get it. And so if you're not completely on some pay of the military industrial complex, or you know, desperately trying to get a job in the Biden administration or something, it's not too hard to see what the ways out are. So the happy point is these are not unsolvable problems. This is not the character of an asteroid coming towards us and we don't know how to handle it. This is completely solvable problems. So we should be happy about that. We should be optimistic about that. We should get to work to solve them.
Professor Sachs, Jeffrey, many thanks. Great privilege to have you in this program.
Real pleasure. Thanks so much.